Welcome to Idle Red Hand, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and the gamer life. You can see us online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. Send us an email at info@idleredhands.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or G+, all of those at idleredhands.com, respectively. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. And we got an email.
Yes! So our thing worked. Kind of.
Well, they knew how to contact us, or the person knew how to contact us.
Right. I'm going to pretend it's because of that teaser Chris did at the beginning.
But I will, too, yeah. So I can feel important.
Right. No, so we got an email from Wade Rocket, the community organizer at 13th Age and Pellegrin Press, about the little, I guess, mini review of the 13th Age bestiary we did at the beginning of the Campaign Confessions 13th Age Part 1 episode. Mm-hmm. And in that episode, we were kind of musing about why they used tiles, for lack of a better term, for the monster pictures in the 13th Age core book. But they went to, full-on traditional pictures for the bestiary. So I'm going to read the email from Wade. According to him, it was a purely artistic decision, not based on space considerations. As someone said on the show, the designers didn't want to lock people into, quote, this is what the 13th Age goblin looks like, end quote. And there's tons of monster illustrations out there for GMs to show players, so Lee and Aaron felt free to try something different. He says, goes on to say that the bestiary was different for a couple of reasons. First, it was an in-house Pellegrin Press book, not a Fire Opal Media-designed book published by Pellegrin. Rich Longmore had his own vision for how he wanted to tackle the art, and whereas the core book presented classic fantasy RPG monsters that we all know by heart, and if we don't, we can Google Gelatinous Cube, the bestiary included new monsters like the Zoragami and all oddball variants of traditional monsters. So, there you go. That's why the 13th Age core book has tiles, but the bestiary has full art.
And now you know the rest of the story.
That's our little behind-the-scenes
Or all of the story.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't want to.
That's nice to know that we guessed correctly.
Well, we also had the space thing, so.
Mm. Right. So, yeah. I guess guessing incorrectly, maybe putting out a bunch of guesses means one of them is going to be correct.
Something stuck, yeah.
Yeah. We did guess correctly for one of the things we put out, yeah.
On the one hand, that fits the philosophy that they had. Like, when they introduced the icons, they introduce it as a mechanic and an idea that people can drop into your own game with your own system. That idea is, this goblin is however you want to imagine it. There's not necessarily going to be a 13th Age goblin.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I can certainly see when Lee and Aaron pitched this, people going, yeah, that's perfect. That really fits with the concept of the book.
Mm.
On the other hand, they provided pictures for the icons.
Yeah, true. I mean, they were kind of not generic-y in a bad sense, but I mean, they were fairly generic pictures of the icons where, you know, as long as you have dwarves, elves, and, druids and stuff like that, then the things would probably work. But yeah, I know what you're saying, Lyle. You're like,
but a book does need pictures,
right,
and
right.
Some of the tiles are amazing in the sense that even with it just being a tile, you know exactly what the monster does for some reason. Just looking at that image, and I'm thinking in particular the Diabolus, or the demonic tiles.
Oh, those were the best. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Those
I'm going to say the best in the sense. In the standalone sense, because you see the full head,
mm-hmm.
and then it's quite easy, and sometimes you see like the hands or the talons, so it's easy to imagine the rest of the body.
Right.
But if you look at a tile like the Storm Giant, that's a great tile in a design sense, but if you are unfamiliar with the Storm Giant, you don't know what it really does.
Mm.
Sounds cool, Storm Giant, cool tile. What does it look like? And of course, you can Google Storm Giant and you'll get a lot of other things, but art looks good in books, so more art is great.
Yeah. It's nice to know the explanation behind it. And now that I do, I really understand what they were going for. But my opinion is still kind of the same that it was before. The Bestiary is a better book with that art in it than without. So, but maybe it's just a bias on my part.
Yeah.
And one thing I don't think we've mentioned since we did the original review of 13th Age is that we really liked the writing style. Mm. It was really accessible. Mm. It's very likable. Like, you like the designers reading it because they're clearly talking to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're throwing things out like, oh, you know, but Jonathan does it this way. But I do it that way.
Mm.
And then as a person reading it, you're like, wow, that's really accessible. I'm really drawn into these rules. They're easy to read. They're fun to read, which is quite a task. And if I had one criticism about the writing, is that it's clearly written for people that are familiar with role-playing games.
Mm.
Because they drop certain things that are for people that are already involved in the hobby. And I think that the writing style works really well for somebody's first game. Like, somebody would pick this up and they thought, I know it's 300 pages, but this is not a chore to go through.
Mm. Right. You said that the writing style was very accessible. But that it was written for people who know how to roleplay.
Yeah, so they drop certain things, like grogs and like terminology like that, and I think they could have stripped all of that away and just made it for everybody.
Mm.
And I think the kind of art, goblins are easily accessible online. You can Google it up, but you throw out a picture of a goblin, and then people go, wow, I want to tell a story with goblins because mm-hmm. I'm just looking at this book.
Or I want to tell a story that doesn't use goblins because look at those things in the book.
Yes.
And that's why they didn't put depictions of the
goblins. Right, right.
Well, you know, I think it kind of harkens back to when we were talking about the Pathfinder book, is a lot of the art in there just really makes me want to play a game featuring that piece of art because it's so gorgeous.
Right.
Like, ideas just jump out of the page for campaigns and whatnot. So it's not to say any knock against the 13th Age book, but it's kind of just something plus alpha that the other book did.
Yeah.
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 Well, and I don't think there's any surprise why a Hezrel made an appearance in my story is because I really like the tile. I looked at it and I'm like, you know, I really want this demon in my story. That looks pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I can see playing it, you know, and that was just a tile, but it happens to be the head.
Mm.
So, yeah. And then when we reviewed the Bestiary, we really loved the interaction of the tiles with the pictures. Like, that the ghoul tile is amazing. Like, from a design standpoint, and actually the ghoul tile, I would say, is like the in-between. Is like, you might be able to like really grasp how that creature, how that monster interacts with the world just from the tile. And it is certainly evocative, but I mean, ghoul pictures are great. So.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't know how to close that.
Yeah, I really didn't know how to end that point.
Right, yeah.
Ghoul pictures are great. Yeah.
Yes, wow. They are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it almost sounds overly simplistic, but yeah, that really is. They are. Do more pictures.
Probably the guy sitting across the table that wanted more pictures in the 13th Age has probably argued it like I just did. But ghoul pictures are great. And they're like, no, you know, we want it to be a 13th Age. Is goblin is anything in your imagination? Yeah, the ghoul pictures are great. Yeah.
So that's
okay, thanks, Lau. Okay, move right now. Oh, and we're going to go with the tiles only. Not the ghoul pictures? No, Lau. Okay. That's great.
Well, if you are.
And you can find those great pictures online.
Yeah, we just give him access to a Google account and it keeps him quiet.
Here's this Google Pinterest we put together for you.
We got just some wallpaper. Great.
Great.
All right. But that actually links quite well into the topic that we have, and it's our second GM corner. So in episode 4, less experienced game masters. And we want to talk about monsters, how to choose them, how to build them, how to make them fresh, both for yourself and for your players. So what we've done is we've come up with a few how points, So what we'll do is we'll go through that. And of course, although we say that it is for inexperienced game masters or less experienced game masters, hopefully there'd be something for the more experienced game master to walk away with. So what was the first point, Wayne?
The first point was how to pick monsters. Because, I mean, you're going to need monsters in your game. And I think when all of us are saying monsters, we're really kind of saying any adversary. I mean, monster's just the easiest to say. But, I mean, if you're running, I don't know, a modern game as opposed to a fantasy game, this could be, you know, regular people as opposed to trolls and orcs and monsters. But just, I find it just easier to say monster. Everybody knows what you're talking about. So. Mm.
Random tables. That's how you do it.
I think cool pictures.
Right.
Wayne, you got to carry this one yourself.
Right. So all of Lyle's games from now on have ghouls in them because of that one picture he looked at. Right.
You know, I say that, you know, whether or not it's a cool picture, but a lot of times, yeah, you look at a picture or you get an image in your mind and you think, you know, I just want that to be in my story because I think describing that to the players would be pretty cool.
Yeah. It's not a picture specifically, but when I ran my big D&D campaign way back when, I put in ghouls specifically because of the ghouls, the way that they were portrayed in the Warcraft 3 war game. Before, there wasn't the MMORG, just the one where you fight other
oh,
things.
Oh, right,
but,
right.
Yeah. But they made them like these kind of spidery monsters, could like climb on walls, and they're really sneaky and evil, and yeah, it was a much further step away from kind of the zombie-esque ghoul that I'd seen previously. So I was like, that's cool. That's going in right now. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, I'd completely forgotten there was Warcraft came before World of Warcraft. Yeah.
Yeah, hey.
Yeah. I'm like, oh. But no, that's certainly one way to pick monsters for your game or for your encounter or your scenario is simply because they are cool. And yeah, you know, flipping through the bestiary or you know, the D&D 5e monstrous manual was released not that long ago. So just, you know, flipping through the pages of that book or any kind of fantasy book or whatever, you're like, oh, that thing, whatever it is awesome. I want to drop it in my game and yeah, show it off to the players. Mm-hmm. So, none of these are mutually exclusive, right? Like, you can blend any of these things together. I guess maybe opposite of simply because it's cool or in a different sense is to either test or show off the rules. So you could be, I don't know, reading the monster stat block, or you could, you know, look at the things it can do mechanically in the game and say, oh, that power looks really cool. Or, I want to show off that, I don't know, that grapple rule because this thing has so many tentacles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a challenging reason to pick a monster to show off rules, but not necessarily to test rules, but to learn rules, even.
Yeah, yeah.
And to get a monster out there. Now, that is certainly a tricky option because you don't want an important encounter to fail.
Right.
Or to seem clumsy because you're trying out new rules. So I guess my only recommendation in that regard is that I wouldn't make it too crucial to the story.
Okay.
Or even to set it up with the players is that you're going to try something new and maybe not tell them, so they still have that element of surprise.
Right.
But then they are prepared for things to go a bit less smoothly than they would normally.
So, yeah, certainly. Maybe I shouldn't have said test the rules. I was thinking more like show off the rules. Like, for example, if you have, I don't know, new players or someone is playing a new class that has something similar to what a monster can do. I don't know. I'm thinking hobgoblins with sword and shield, right? And there's some kind of mechanic where they can use their shield to do something cool, like shield bash or whatever. Showing that off or showing monsters doing it can, you know, indicate to the players, hey, here's something you can do too. That's kind of what I was thinking of. You know?
Yeah, this is ages ago, like my high schooling days, but I think I remember the only example I can actually remember of something like this is I used a gremlin from probably maybe like second edition D&D, but they had a special rule where it was, I think, called the Chaos Aura, where anything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Hmm.
And it was, I don't remember the specifics of it, but it was kind of a lot of fun where you could just make up things, you know, like the head flying off of your axe when you're doing it, or, you know, the table that you tried to jump on, it just breaks and falls out from underneath you. I remember it being a very fun encounter because of that rule specifically.
Were you the GM or the player?
I was the GM, and I'm sure the players didn't have anywhere near as much fun as I did.
All right, there you go. Yeah, I was wondering. You can say, yeah, this was loads of fun when everything broke and nothing went right. And I'm like, not for the players.
I can think of a few other examples, like using, for example, like blink dogs, which are monsters that can teleport freely. I think that could be a fun encounter because of their movement abilities. Such. I've seen monsters that kind of act as terrain, you know, where you fight on the monster or something like that. It could be a lot of fun.
I think a different way to put it might be to show off abilities or powers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to rules.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably a better way to say it. Yeah. Or even show off options, like this monster is equipped very similar to what you are, and look what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way you're describing it, though, I think is a good way for an experienced game master to get less experienced players familiar with certain rules.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Like they introduce a monster that has a lot of immunities, so then the players can work at trying to figure out what's going to affect it.
You use these monsters when you've given the players advice, but they don't listen, so you have to beat it into them.
Well, that's just being mean.
And since we talked about it, choosing monsters to suit a story.
Right. Yeah, maybe a gripe here, because, hey, it's me, but it seems like certain, fantasy modules, lots of monsters work together simply because they are bad, which never really made any sense to me. So, like, when we were playing Dungeons & Dragons 3.5, Lyle, I had kind of set the game up to be about Underdark and Drow, so even though I was basing it on a module, I changed a lot of the monsters to things that would, indicate Drow more strongly. So I dropped a lot of, goblins and other things and put in Drow and Driders. So,
well, that's actually something I wanted to ask you guys when we first started talking about this topic, is I wondered, do you follow dungeon ecology? Do the monsters have to make sense for the location and scene they're in? Does it have to make sense that they would be working together?
Well, and that gets into another point about suiting the location.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a big influence on me, is that there has to be a story. Like if you had an NPC starting to talk about the monster,
mm-hmm.
that there's some sort of story behind it. So in the 13th Age story, the Darrows live, and it's not a huge stretch. The corrupted dwarves live in the abandoned dwarven city.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there's a story about them falling. Beneath them live the
Sahagwin.
The Sahagwin are the scaly ones, as they were referred to in the story. There was actually a backstory there that wasn't non-important at all for the adventure, but at least for me, they made sense. And I think that allows the game master, if it makes sense to them, it allows them to more confidently play them. And gives them more ideas of when they would appear and not appear in the story.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, I think I'm the same way. Like, every once in a while a monster pops up that, maybe shouldn't be there. But generally, I like the monsters to follow kind of the internal logic of whatever fantasy setting or whatever setting you're playing in. So, if magic is real, or if the dragon can get through those front doors, then it's going to be down there in the bottom of the dungeon. But if all the doors you've passed and the only doors in this dungeon are little, 5 foot wide things, then how is there a dragon in the middle of this room with no exit? So kind of similar to Lyle, I like there to be a reason or a plausible explanation for how this thing got there or why this thing is there, even if the players don't know what it is. And sometimes that will never come up during the story, and it doesn't matter to the story. But as Lyle said, as long as I, the GM, know how this thing got there.
Yes, I'm so there. I just can't help but world build, There's even if the players never investigated, I've probably thought about it in creating the monsters in the campaign.
Right. I mean, it can be like a rabbit hole that you fall down where, you do end up building an ecology, and then...
single time.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes, you just kind of have to go where, this is, what genre is this game? What is appropriate for the story to be here?
Mm-hmm.
Now let's kind of figure out a reason why it could be here so that it makes some sense,
Hmm. And, yeah. You know, that adds depth to it. You know, if there is a dragon behind a 5-foot wide door, then the question, how the heck did this get here, becomes a legitimate question.
Mm,
and
yeah.
You can.
It was there talk. As a baby.
Right.
Yeah. No, I'm the same way. And it's caused me to maybe not scrap, but modify encounters because I just think, oh, the players are going to ask why.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm asking why. Like, I watch a lot of CinemaSins on YouTube where they pick apart movies. So you know, when you're planning an encounter, I'm almost picking it apart as if somebody were watching as if it were a movie.
Right.
Even though I don't know, I'm just thinking, what are some ways that the players can interact with this? And is it natural? Is it going to make sense to them? Mm-hmm. Is it going to feel forced?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think those questions can be helpful, but of course, maybe not let ecology get in the way of something that's cool.
Right. I guess another way to pick monsters is, we've kind of touched on that before, is to challenge the party. You know the party has a certain set of skills, or you know that the characters can do certain things, and so you specifically pick a monster or an adversary that will, you know, either find a weak spot in their skills or challenge them, get them to really, you know, struggle against the thing.
And we call this person a killer game master.
Okay.
Well, you know, actually,
or an adversarial game master.
I said challenge, not kill. I mean, if you just wanted to kill them, you just do the rocks fall from the ceiling and everyone dies thing. But,
well, you know,
this
is actually the one thing on the list that I had a little bit of an issue with, in that it's kind of odd that you would choose a monster that doesn't challenge the party. I mean, of course, there's different varying degrees of challenges, and of course, there's also the kind of the minion fight where you just want to wade through lots of lower level or lower hit point monsters to make the characters feel awesome. But I think in general, there should be some order of challenge to almost every monster encounter.
That's a fair point, and then I can see why, you know, you saying that it shouldn't be on the list because it applies to all of the things you pick.
But is that kind of, maybe I just didn't understand what you were going for. Is it something to where you might choose this monster specifically because it's going to beat up the players, or?
I didn't mean beat up, but I mean, maybe it's a bit of a dick move, but if the players, you know, always kind of solve encounters the same way, or they always solve problems the same way, well, then that's your chance as GM to pick something that they specifically cannot beat the way they have been doing in the past.
Oh, nice, nice.
Drop it in their path. And, yeah, exactly.
Ideas.
Basically, just like, what are you going to do now? Because the tactics you have been using before simply will not work.
Well, that's good. Yeah, no issues with that.
True, but it can be a really slippery slope or get pretty close to the edge of, you know, a TPK, or you look like a jerk GM, you know. Mm-hmm.
Or you're playing a board game.
Or you're playing a board game where you kind of have the arms race a little bit, I guess, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, but where you're just throwing out challenges. I can see it definitely as a separate point in that, yeah, if you're choosing a monster because it's cool for the story, the monster might not, or the adversary or the antagonist might not actually be that challenging in any type of adversarial encounter.
Mm, right.
Mm-hmm. But they're very good for the story, and somehow the encounter with the party is going to move them on to something else. Or it could be some sort of moral dilemma, or it could be a clue, or it can be all these things. But maybe you're choosing, let's say, a monster because of that flavor. You could just actually give them the clue, but if they sort of beat it out of this creature, or by beating it they discover something, that's actually adding to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the mood, then I can see how you wouldn't want to necessarily just challenge them.
Right. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
So, and sometimes you might choose a monster that's impossible to beat. So it's not so much a challenge, but it would be a death sentence if they were to go against it.
Or it's a test to see how smart your players are. Like, great, we charge her in full bore, and you're like, roll up new characters.
You do realize that thing's a terror skew, right?
Right. It's like, and you're done. Give me your characters. Yeah.
That's a legitimate thing. We've talked about it before on the podcast, is how whether you go with game balance to where every encounter is something that is balanced for the players to be able to theoretically defeat, versus one where it's a realistic kind of world where it doesn't matter if you're a very low level, if you walk into a dragon's cave knowing that it's dragon's cave, there's going to be a dragon there, and you're not going to be able to beat it by yourself.
Right. So. Yeah, and as Lyle was saying before, that's kind of a way where picking monsters or, you know, to suit the story can end up being a cakewalk for the players.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why, at the beginning we said all these aren't mutually exclusive, and you can have several reasons for picking a specific monster. Yeah.
Well, the second point that we had was how to make the monsters interesting. And to me, this is a much more interesting point than just how to pick them.
Right. And in this case, we're talking about before you actually kind of put the monster on the field, so to speak. So if you tweak stats or numbers. So for example, adding or removing an ability. I don't know why you would do this, but hey, everybody knows dragons have breath weapons. So to make the monster different, I would say lamer, you could, take away that breath weapon. Don't know why, that's just the first thing that
how
popped
to make
in my
monsters
head.
Less interesting.
Yep, how to make monsters less interesting. Is that a
dragon? This is the kind of thing where you, I know we're talking about for kind of newbie GMs, but if your players have any experience at all, if you just drop in vanilla goblins with them, it's probably not going to be that interesting of an encounter, just because they have too much experience with other more interesting things for it. So the idea is if you are going to drop in some goblins, don't make them vanilla. As Wayne said, give them extra abilities. That doesn't have to be magical or physical abilities only. It can be different kinds of tactics that they might use, or give them a different kind of intelligence level, or even different takes on the encounter, whereas they might not be interested in fighting. They want to talk about something. It doesn't always have to be a physical encounter.
That gets into the other point of motivation.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
So they might always have the ability to speak, but the willingness or the desire to speak with the players as opposed to attack them is you're giving them some sort of motivation other than attack.
Right.
Yeah. I've seen stripping away abilities, you read it in stories, working for monsters and making them fresh. People start to think of Smaug as the dragon. Very intelligent, very powerful breath weapon, as you said, but then you start to remove it and you make it more, the dragon more bestial,
mm-hmm.
then it becomes, you strip away a lot of the fantasy, and that, in a sense, can make it more real.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly that. And of course, adding things would be unexpected, but yeah, I think motivation can be really important, and it gets into, ties back to the ecology. Why are they there?
Mm, yeah.
And why are they there? What do they want out of this story? Because they're part of the story as well. We often don't tell their story, but how do they see the protagonists? How do mm-hmm. they see the players?
How do they see themselves?
Yeah. And I thought that was really good about the 13th Age bestiary, where they had those mini lists at the beginning of the book, like monsters that would negotiate.
Yeah, totally. I was going to say that same thing. That's a fantastic part of that book.
Yeah, and thinking about that with what the monster is, would this monster negotiate? Would it run away? Why does it dislike the players? If it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe they're just there randomly. So,
mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that gets into, as we said before, knowing the motivation for the monster would tell you how to play them better.
So. Absolutely. This is something that I learned early on in GMing, is that you do plan for the meat of the fight, the actual combat itself, but something really important is to plan for the end of the fight. What happens when the monsters get down to low HP? Do they run away? Do they fight to the death? Do they try and negotiate? All that. Vice versa, what happens if the monsters begin to win? Are they going to slaughter the PCs? Are they going to try and take them prisoner? Do they gloat? How do they react? The end of the fight is just as important as the fight itself.
Right. I maybe even more so, I would say.
Yeah.
What is, this gets back to what Lyle said, what is the goal? What do they want? I highly doubt monsters enter fights just to have fights, because that's what player characters do. Well, actually, no, that's a lot.
Murder hobos, yeah.
Yeah, murder hobos. They want XP and loot. Meanwhile, I guess the flip side of that is monsters probably want to not be murdered and to keep their loot. So, if they can do either of those things, that's probably what they're going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's so easy to forget about how to end it. And I think it's a really good point there, because oftentimes you get locked into the combat and it just drudgery, and then it just kind of ends.
mm-hmm. with one side getting slaughtered or the other.
Yeah, once it's dead. Now move on to the next thing.
Right.
And you think about a lot of the action movies. They can there might be a really interesting build up. I guess a decent second act, and they try to introduce characterization, mm-hmm. and then the third act. I guess I'm talking about Michael Bay movies, where it's
what it's just right. characterization.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just an orgy of action, and you're like, I don't really know why they're fighting, other than I guess one's good and one's bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who's who.
Right. Yeah. I don't know who's who. I don't really know why I should be caring. The only thing that's telling me this is tense is because the music is kind of tense.
Mm-hmm. And again, why did you make them all silver?
Right.
But yeah, the motivation can be like, what if they start begging? So you get them down and they start begging for their life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have something to offer. Just a recent game I was playing, Rifts. And it wasn't so much a fight. I mean, it was a very quick encounter. We were able to subdue this, I think it was an elf mage, quite quickly. Mm-hmm. He was clearly outnumbered. So that elf's motivation was really important. Why did it go into the city alone?
Mm-hmm.
How did it hope to get out of this situation?
Mm.
And that led to a really satisfying negotiation and deal made between us and this character. Maybe he will end up betraying us later on, but we had a deal. We found out, what does it really want? And he was finding out, well, what we want. And mm-hmm. yeah, I thought that the motivations were really working and made for a really satisfying encounter.
Nice.
In contrast to a lot of other encounters where who is inside that robot, or why was this monster here?
Yeah. Because
even henchmen. Yeah, I mean, we often give villains a lot of motivation, and in the stories or movies, books you read, the decent ones will give you some ideas as to how the main villain feels or thinks, but you don't know why the others are around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why do the minions stick with this megalomaniacal guy? Do they actually want to live in a volcano fortress? I think not.
No, they want to live in a flying cocoon.
You know, I just was thinking, I just thought of this movie, Bruce Willis movie called Hostage. It was on TV the other week. And there's three antagonists. There's actually more, but there's three main ones in the beginning. But they all have very different motivations. And you explore it. I think it made the movie better. Because you could interact with each one differently.
Hmm.
And then, of course, they have their own conflicts because their motivations are different.
Mm-hmm.
So,
not asking for spoilers, but did the antagonists have similar goals?
Two of them did.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. But then two of them had a strong relationship.
Hmm.
So it was nicely done. I mean, it's not the best movie in the world, but it was certainly a satisfying movie, and one of that was because of the motivations that they gave the antagonist.
Right.
So,
I think that's a really important point, you know? Yeah, even minions need those motivations, because otherwise they're just going to tuck tail and run as soon as one of them dies.
Sorry, Chris, to interrupt you. I just want to... And I think this gets into... It goes back to what we're talking about in ecology and what, you know, Chris was talking about world building, and Wayne, you were saying, is like, it's got to make sense to you.
Mm.
And sometimes these motivations will never actually come out in the story. Like, the players aren't going to ask them, they're just going to cut off his head.
Right.
But to you, that
more often than not,
that monster makes sense. Not only because of it makes sense to be in that environment, but it also makes sense because it has that motivation and those goals. So the way you've been playing the monster makes sense to you, and I think then you'll more confidently play the monster, more convincingly play the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you never get to the point and it was like, oh, I think I just want to be loved. You know, I was abandoned as, you know, abandoned as a hatchling, you know.
That's the little...
Abandoned in this room, you know.
Right.
At this door, I can't get through this door. All I want to do is get out. Right. I'm trying to attack the party. I was like, open the door, let me get out.
Right. Hey, they just opened that door. That's the one way out. Here I go. And that's its internal monologue as it slowly bleeds out on the floor as, I just wanted to be free.
That roar was just, sad. Hey, guys!
He's so happy.
That's incredibly sad.
No, I'm going to cry for that thing.
A dragon that has never seen the sun, never interacted with people. It didn't know what anything was. It just wanted out, and you killed it. Good job, guys.
I was kissing you with my fire. What's that? You know how you kiss? You know, I heard, like, now. Love is hot.
You know, we're talking about this, about how the monsters have their own, kind of their own motivation and how that can really enhance the story. I kind of want to put a contrary point into that, that it's important to consider the meta as well, the actual game aspect of it. I remember a campaign I played a very, very long time ago where we were facing, ghouls and zombies, but they had it to where once they reached a certain level, they would try and retreat away from the party. And it was interesting that that was their tactic. It wasn't just a fight to the death, but they were kind of the primary stock monster of the game. And after a while, it got kind of annoying, because when you get down to a certain point, they'd all start running away, and you didn't want to let undead loose in the city because they could spread their undeadness. So you'd have to chase them all down, and it got a little repetitive after a while. So that's something else to consider.
Well, I think that's the problem, and not that they were... you know, anyone was going overboard, but that it got repetitive because they were all doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, they were all the same type of monster. Mm. You know, it sounds like they were all, you know, zombies, so, you know, it kind of makes sense for them to have all the same motivation, but, yeah, you got to mix it up. And I don't know why I'm thinking of video games all of a sudden, but, you know, like, maybe it was a zombie thing, but, like, in a first-person shooter or any kind of game, like, the monsters don't act the same, you know? Some of them will run away after they get hit, but others will just, like, stay and fight or sneak away and try and ambush you. So I think you have to do the same thing. You can't give all the monsters the same motivation just to live, you know?
You guys raise a good point. Wayne saying, like, mix and match, and just because you're calling it the same thing doesn't mean it has to behave the same way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. People don't behave the same way.
And neither should zombies.
Yeah, exactly, because zombies were people at one time.
There you go.
Yeah, and again, it gets back to story. Like, why are you introducing them? Are you introducing them to, like, a wave of zombies? And I'm not sure why zombies would run away, but maybe it was the ghouls that were running away.
Yeah, maybe.
Zombies are usually relentless.
It was, yeah. The ghouls.
Okay. Yeah.
Ghouls just want to be loved.
Yeah. And another way you can make them interesting, and that, again, getting back to location, is putting them in an unexpected location.
Like a dragon in a small room?
Like a dragon in a small room. Or, instead of the bottom level of a dungeon, the top level of a tower. There you go.
No? Yeah. No. Yeah. Some good examples there, guys.
All right.
How about a vampire in the day? Bad idea.
Mind blown.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
He's sparkling? What is that? Who thought of this?
Yeah, poor vampire's internal monologue. I thought this would be a good idea, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's certain monsters you expect to find in the snow.
Hmm.
And there might be certain things that you don't expect to find in the snow. But maybe something even simpler, and this gets into less fantastic antagonists, is like things in the city and things not in the city. Like an urban versus a rural environment, and what you would find.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Right.
A bear in an office building.
All right.
You know, I'm actually going to ask it what its motivation is, because this is weird. What's with the briefcase, dude?
Growl. Just trying still to change a bear. The copier. Yeah. All right. No, I'm trying to think of like a. An example from Supernatural, because for some reason, again, that's popping into my head. And, you know, you tend to think of certain types of monsters as being restricted to a certain locale or a certain type of environment, and so displacing that monster could kind of throw the players for a loop a little bit. I mean, especially if you're doing a more investigative game, because they may write that monster off since it's, quote, in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know we're kind of leaning away from the fantasy trope, but my mind jumped there immediately. You know, finding a red dragon in an Arctic climb, you know, that could be, that it would raise questions for certain. Why is it here?
Right, right. Which goes all the way back to, hey, as long as you have a plausible explanation for why it's there, even if it doesn't come up during the game, you know, that'll help.
I mean, for example, in the city, there's certain animals you expect to see. Raccoons.
Roaches.
Squirrels. Rats,
Yeah. People.
So they all share a common element of being boring. but if you had, for example, what do you call those? A horde? I think it's a horde of baboons. Mm-hmm. So you take some sort of monkeys or something and a group of them, and they now occupy maybe abandoned buildings or whatever, and they create their own little, you know, I'm thinking Jungle Book and the orangutan and the monkeys.
Yeah, but they were friendly. They were friendly in the Jungle Book.
Were they?
Mildly.
No. He wanted man's red flower.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
So they could have. I mean, you go into there's reports, or even gets into Edgar Allan Poe's mystery, where the murderer turned out to be an orangutan.
Right.
Yeah, and they couldn't figure it out, because it was a creature that was in an unusual location or unexpected. But yeah, you walk into this abandoned building and you expect maybe to see nothing, or maybe to see homeless people, or, oh, it's going to be vampires. And you're like, whoa, it's a horde of baboons that are intelligent and have motivations.
And all the players immediately leave. All the characters, we are gone.
But even when you put it in an unexpected location, I still think you should think of the ecology. Like, even though you're putting monkeys, and actually some monkeys do invade into, I think Brazil has monkeys that have become like urban animals, and certainly there's the snow monkeys in Japan, which enjoy dipping into hot
baths,
springs.
Yeah.
Macau, what are they called? Macau monkeys?
I thought it was like snow macaques or something. I don't know. What about you call a horde of chimpanzees?
Tribe, isn't it? Troop, there it is. Troop. Of chimps.
Yeah. Or is it? Ooh, there's a mob. I think a mob is, wait a minute, meerkat.
A mob of meerkats? Okay.
Yeah.
No, but you're right. You're right about, you should
hold
still
on,
think
hold on.
Of some kind of ecology.
Murder of crows.
Yes, murder of crows.
I was thinking the same one.
My fraternity, Alpha Chi Rho, we were called the crows, so... The rush flyers I put up was join the murder. Yep, that didn't go over too well with campus life.
You guys, what are we, Revenge of the Nerds 4? What is this?
No, because Revenge of the Nerds 4, I think, is when they started getting cool. We're probably around Revenge of the Nerds like 1.
You guys are Revenge of the Nerds, the prequel. Well,
probably.
Pre-Revenge Nerds.
Pre-Revenge.
Just the Nerds.
Right. But anyway, can go all the way back.
Yeah, you know, I think monkeys in a city environment could be a lot of fun, because being arboreal creatures, they could
climb.
Work in a city environment very well. Yeah.
Yep.
And you think about especially in a ruined building where there wouldn't be any windows or doors in the way, they could use those awnings and ledges and flagpoles and all kinds of things to move around really well. You could pull out some amazing tactics against player characters just by way of the monkey's natural movement.
Well, since
I was thinking of putting him in a story, and it's funny that you mentioned about the ghouls and the climbing the walls, because that's why I thought of them. Then I thought of the jumping around, but the first thing was I wanted something that could climb walls and then come from above. Because that is pretty scary. I don't know why Spider-Man's a hero.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because he's just dead on creepy. Yeah. You might as well just wear a clown mask, spider clown.
Oh, man.
And just combine those two things.
Thank you very much for my nightmares tonight. All right. Speaking of, kind of stuck on urban, but, Chris describing the monkeys kind of using this urban arboreal environment. Do you guys see the abandoned shopping mall? I believe it's in China that is now, filled up with water and has its own aquatic ecosystem inside it.
I have not. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's just this abandoned shopping mall, a hole in the roof, the bottom floor or basement's filled up, and now it is full of koi. So it's something that's kind of in an unexpected location. Like, you would not expect an abandoned building to be an aquatic environment, but now
it is. I would love
to
play a game in there. Like, put a set of campaign in there and fill it with zombies underwater. That'd be so much fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a trope of normal horror movies, isn't it? It's like, and now we got to go through the sunken levels. You're like, okay.
Oh, I said, well, zombies in a mini mall, in a shopping mall, that's kind of a trope, but fill it with water. Yeah, trope.
Fill it with water, yeah.
But something, zombies in a mall wasn't a trope until Dawn of the Dead. And, Romero put them in there, making that commentary on consumerism and that. But He puts him in there, and then it becomes the thing.
Hmm.
But before that, it wasn't a thing.
Everything has to start somewhere.
So you, first-time game master, could make the thing the next thing.
The water-filled zombie mini-mall.
But don't don't use the thing from the movie The Thing to be your thing.
Because that thing is already a thing.
A thing.
Right. All right. Anyway.
So, of course, that leads into our next how point, which is how to make fighting monsters more interesting. Because, okay, you've put them in there, but now they're going to have a conflict with the players.
Yeah, conflict is probably better because, I mean, if you're talking about monsters, I mean, fight might be the usual or expected thing, but...
Yeah, we talk all about this motivation and that. All right, now, let's get down to fighting.
What's their motivation? Kill you. All right.
But as long as you got that down, you're going to play them more convincingly.
Yeah, No, but one way to make them more interesting or more dangerous is to, use the environment. So, as Lyle just said, like, nobody really expects someone to drop down on them from a spider's web wearing a clown mask, you know? So...
I did not expect that, no.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, use the environment to your advantage,
But who walks up to a giant spider web? It's like, this is a giant spider web. I get really close.
Adventures all
it doesn't
the
really
time.
Matter what jumps down. It's like,
you deserved it.
Have you watched it? Yeah, you've watched enough horror movies. You should know, Lyle. Hell, there's something stuck on that wall. It looks like it could be a web. Let's go look at it real close.
Here's like a D&D horror movie. It was like, I hear a noise. I throw Greek fire at it. Yeah. It's dead. Okay, movie's over.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it was maybe an article from D&D 4E that was talking about dragons and how to use dragons within their environments. Because a lot of dragons have resistances against their specific type of environment. Mm. For example, a red dragon isn't harmed by heat, so it could... theoretically, like, live in a pool of lava where the players couldn't access it.
Right.
If it were losing a fight, it could just dive in there. Green and or black dragons can breathe underwater, so the idea of them sneaking up on a party in a swamp like a submarine and then surfacing and diving back under for a surprise attack. The kind of the small, almost afterthought abilities that some monsters have could really make the environment and the encounter much more interesting and more dangerous. I'm thinking something like orcs, which have either dark vision or low light vision.
Right.
But if they attacked a party in the dark, that would totally turn the balance towards their end.
Right. You're talking about the red dragon with heat resistance living in a pool of lava. Kind of reminds me of the Capcom game Monster Hunter, where you had to go to different environments. And yeah, certain monsters did live in lava that you, the player, could not get into, or water environments, and they would jump around from these pools, and it became really annoying and a challenge to hit them. So, I mean, maybe I wouldn't go that far in your game because it, as I said, got a bit annoying. Or I'm thinking of the Pathfinder game we played, Chris, where, dragons fly, so this thing is not going to land. Mm-hmm. However, we can't hit it. This is getting a little bit frustrating.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, that's something you really want to make a monster challenging, give it wings.
You really want to make it challenging, yeah, just...
Seriously, you know, in a fantasy game, there's there's magic and there's missile weapons, and that's not how most players are kitted out. Give something wings, and the party suddenly can't hurt it very well.
Right, now you're just being a dick GM.
Well, yeah, I suppose one of those things, you know, if you want to really challenge the party or make them think three-dimensionally.
Hmm.
And there's other ways they can use the environment. It's like using setting up traps.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
When you were talking about the dragon is in fire and in lava. But I was thinking they could splash the party with lava.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. Yeah, it could, if you have a burrowing creature, maybe it's very, really clever. Or, you know, thinking about the meerkats, maybe they burrow under the ground and people walk on it and it collapses.
They mob
and then
you.
They attack. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they put little spikes in the bottom of that burrow.
Yeah. Or camouflage. You know, they blend into the environment. I mean... But what would Predator be if he didn't have that camouflage?
True.
Yeah.
I mean, going...
That's still pretty badass. Yeah, but...
camouflage. That wasn't camouflage. That's straight up invisibility. But, yeah, that classic D&D monster example, the Mimic. There you go. Using camouflage and, you know, using the environment. What is it going to turn into so that it blends in with its surroundings? A treasure chest in the treasure room. Yeah, okay. But, hey, if you're doing it for the first time, still exciting.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you scar your players. We don't open the chest.
And talking about that, using traps, you know, having different kinds of tactics attached to monsters can also make them kind of give it a whole new twist and a whole new interesting way of fighting. I remember a game that I played a long time ago. There was lots of different kinds of humanoids, orcs, goblins, hobgoblins, etc. And we always feared the hobgoblins the most because they their alignment was lawful evil as opposed to chaotic evil for the orcs. Orcs would just charge in and try and hit you, but hobgoblins would set up traps. They would use command. They would have lines of assault, and then they would fall back and or bolster those lines. They were much, much more dangerous, not because of their physical stats, but because of their tactics.
Well, this is kind of an example of, you know, blending the two, where you can make the monster interesting by adding or removing an ability, in this case, alignment. Okay. If the players assume that all orcs are chaotic and they'll just kind of attack in a disorganized mob, well, then mix it up a little bit. And hey, those orcs, despite the fact that they're not, you know, hobgoblins or whatever, they actually fight as a coordinated unit. Because yeah. I'm kind of thinking of Lord of the Rings, where...
Yeah, I'm thinking the same one, that albino orc, huh?
Oh, well, I was just thinking of the Uruk-hai in general, because until you met the Uruk-hai, then the orcs and goblins were, yeah, kind of disorganized and, you know, didn't really fight all that well. I mean, they were still dangerous in a mob, but then you got the Uruk-hai who actually made formations with those pikes and fought intelligently with tactics. So, yeah, that they became different and scary, and it's like, okay, and now we have to adapt to what they are doing, and we thought we were going against this, but, well, nope, it's completely different. Maybe a little bit tough to replicate in the game when, again, you're running into the problem of there's only going to be so many monsters in the area, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, but, I mean, if you have high enough level characters, they can take on a lot of lower-level monsters, and you just put in some tactics, and it's much more dangerous.
Well, it also gets into the point where if you have ghouls that continuously run away, maybe these ghouls will have a different tactic. Yeah, I mean, it can dress up. If you talk about vampire movies, people are used to seeing vampires as solo acts. Because they're used to, like, Dracula and keep that up, and maybe they have some minions, and then you progress to something like 30 Days of Night, and now they're a whole pack of vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Or Near Dark, which is, in my opinion, the best vampire movie ever made. You know, you have a pack or a tribe of vampires there. And how they would work that. How do they get their victims?
Right.
And work together. So,
which blends very well into another way to make them interesting is, you know, pair monsters up with other monsters, both kind of logical and unexpected choices. Like, yeah, as Lyle said, people are used to seeing vampires as a solo act, so, nope, now there's a group of them, because then they're going to work together, and that fight's going to be, or that encounter is going to be different than if you had just come across one by itself.
Oh, yeah. Well, you had that. You mentioned goblins. You have goblins. You put them on a dire wolf, and whoa, kind of badass now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you take the goblin off. Still kind of badass. All right.
One of the ways they would pair up is one has raised or trained the other one since it was a baby. Rereading Harry Turtledove's Into Darkness series.
Okay.
It's World War II in a fantasy world.
Okay.
And they have dragons, and here's a case of where they take a lot away from the dragon, namely its intelligence. And now people ride on the dragons, and it makes sense why they would let them ride, because what they've done is they've raised them and beat them from hatchlings. So these very dumb and vicious dragons now allow a human to ride on it and control it. And in that respect, because they are so dumb, the humans provide the intelligence, the direction, the focus, the discipline. And then they provide the fire and the ability to fly. And, all right. Well, let's move on to the last point. And, you know, you've run a lot of monsters. And, of course, you go to a monster manual or a bestiary, and you found some interesting ones. And then you've made your tweaks. You've given it the motivation. You've put it in a logical location. Some people think, you know, I want to do more. There's a lot of cool monsters in this book, but... it's not exactly what I'm looking for. So that leads us into the point, the final point of how to make monsters or how to build monsters.
Right. The easiest way is, of course, just to reskin something else. Where that's just
exactly the point I was going to say.
Yeah, you take the monster completely as is and you just make it look different, but you don't change any of the mechanics or the numbers or the game abilities. Sorry, I stole the easiest one.
Sorry. Yep, I agree completely. That's a great way for new GMs to get started into building monsters, because you can build the story and idea around the monster as well as the description, but you don't have to worry about the mechanical balance or screwing around with all the different kinds of numbers for it.
I tend to think reskinning gets a bad rap because it's kind of seen as maybe being lazy because it is an easy way to do it, but I don't know. I don't think it gets enough credit because why do you need to... Sometimes you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the best thing to do is just say, that's exactly what I wanted. It just looks different than what I imagined, so we'll change that, and there you go. Mm-hmm. And you've saved yourself a lot of work.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, I mean, it can get a bad rap if you don't do much with it. You reskin it, it's got to feel like its own monster.
Right, fair enough.
I think it's a bad rep when somebody reskins it and it doesn't really feel like anything different.
Right, you're like, hold on, that dragon doesn't have breath weapon? No, he's just attacking with this little D4? Why? Oh, you reskinned another goblin. Great. Yeah. No, I can see that.
What?
I'm saying, if a GM is really
lazy... You've made a dragon out of a goblin?
Right, if someone is really, really lazy, and they just keep reskinning this one thing as everything you encounter, it's going to get old.
It's less lazy, it's just strange.
Okay, fine, fair enough.
It's unexpected. It's tiny. It's a tiny little dragon. It's so cute.
It's adorable.
All right.
Sorry, dude.
I think the great thing about reskinning is you don't have to worry about the mechanics because it's already done for you.
Right.
And then all you have to worry about is the role-playing.
For all the its faults, one of the things that I enjoyed about Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition was the powers system that they used for the monsters. They made it really easy to build your own monsters because you could just lift the breath weapon power off of a dragon and then slap it onto a different creature to give it that kind of an ability. And that's a way to think about building monsters, too, in a game, is to simply look at the powers that some monsters have individually by themselves and simply just copy them over onto another kind of monster. And then you can create a new kind of creature.
Hmm, yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of like a step up in simplicity from reskinning. You know, you kind of...
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I'm a different way of going about...
No, absolutely, but it's depending on the system.
I'm going to say it is and it isn't.
Right, okay.
I think you're right in a case like maybe Pathfinder, mm-hmm. which has more complicated stats for monsters, but if you take a game like 13th Age, mm-hmm. where it's really stripped down the monsters, where their kind of signature power is very easy to just take out and throw it into another monster. It's a great mm-hmm. way to make a monster more powerful, mm. lift the power from another creature and put it on. It's mm-hmm. it's a great way to put a monster in another environment. So you put that giant spider and you say, well, it's going to be like a snow spider, a giant snow spider. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, how do I make it feel like a snow spider? Well, lift this breath weapon from the white dragon, boom, plop him in.
Mm. Right.
So these are just some ideas of how you can select and make your monsters more interesting. There are a lot of good books out there that do have monsters or do have antagonists that you can use in your game, but you certainly don't feel bound by them and certainly don't think that you can't mix and match what's in there.
And, of course, depending on what system you're playing, the other way to just kind of build monsters is make them from PCs, because mm-hmm. every game has PC creation rules.
That's true. That's true. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.